Operation Chokehold. I mean, the government, the government, and I think it's really not just the government, but I think it's the banks behind the government. I think it's the Jamie Dimons of the world. I mean, all of these people understand what an existential threat Bitcoin is to their models and to their business. We're either heading to a world where we're going to have really high inflation for a bunch of years, and I kind of like to think of like Argentina, you know, where inflation is just going to become a fact of life. It's going to suck, but it will live with it. And, you know, at least people will be working and the economy will be running. It's just that everything will always be getting more expensive. People are going to be really pissed off. It's also possible that we could go the hyperinflation route. A lot of it depends. It depends on two things.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Blockware Intelligence Podcast. This week I have on Lawrence Lepard. Lawrence, welcome.
Hey, nice to be with you, Joe. Thanks for the invite.
Of course. Glad to have you. Let's jump right into it. How does, with everything that's going on right now, it's pretty crazy times. How does this banking crisis compare to previous ones you've experienced? I mean, I think I just saw on Twitter, Credit Suisse credit default swaps are soaring. We've had, you know, Silicon Valley Bank fail. We've had Silvergate fail. How does this compare to other crises you've?
You know, they all rhyme, and it's very similar, but they're each different, of course, in their own respects. I mean, you know, the most probably the most comparable one, obviously, is 2008 and the housing crisis. And I just wrote a letter to some of my investors, and I said that, you know, I think we just saw a very big card with the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, and then, you know, the establishment of this new credit facility, this lending facility. And it kind of reminds me a little bit of in the summer of 2000, in the run up to 2008, I was short the financials. You could see there was a bubble. I kind of had the Michael Burry trade on, although I didn't know what a CDS was, so I was just short financials. But you could see the housing stuff was nuts, and you knew it was nuts. And in the summer of 2007, the Bear Stearns funds blew up. They had a couple of funds that focused on CDS, and they went BK like really quick. And we were all like, uh-oh, that's, you know, there's the start. But that's the summer of 2007. Remember, the GFC didn't really erupt until September, October of 2008. And then in March of 2008, Bear Stearns itself actually failed and got taken over by J.P. Morgan, you know, for $2, and I was short that stock. And you know, it was, you could just kind of see the creeping trouble emerging. It was different, but it was in many ways similar. And I don't know. I mean, there's someone who said, "Well, this is it. We're going to fail tomorrow." I'm not so sure. I mean, it's hard to know the slope of the lines, but. But clearly cracks are emerging and they're getting bigger. Or another metaphor, I think, is they're putting their fingers in the holes in the dike and new holes keep popping up. I mean, as we all know, Silicon Valley Bank failed last week. Well, now Credit Suisse is on the ropes. You know, the Saudis said they're not going to do any financing. The CDS is blowing out. I think it was just on the tape that the Swiss government is talking to them. So probably there's going to be either a nationalization or a takeover of Credit Suisse to prevent that from happening, and that's a big one, by the way. It's $27 billion. It's a G-SIB. The Fed cares, and the thing that actually hasn't really been talked about much in any of these discussions. I mean, you know, in the case of Silicon Valley Bank, it was long duration versus short duration that caused the problem. You know, short-term deposits, long duration assets that had fallen in value because of the rise in interest rates. I mean, the other thing that people aren't really talking about is all the derivatives. You know, all these banks have just enormous amounts of derivatives, and Credit Suisse is one of the largest. And you know, derivatives are in a sense what Buffett said. You know, financial weapons of mass destruction. You know, we could. So you get a derivative blow up, and you know, things could accelerate a great deal. Having said that, you know, the powers that be are going to try and hold everything together, and I'm sure they're. You know, the exchange stabilization funds got a bit underneath the market and so on and so forth. So, but I guess the big, you know, what's the real big takeaway from this? The takeaway from the last week or two, in my mind, is that those of us who said, and I'm sure you're among us, who said you can't taper a Ponzi, you know, they have to continually grow credit in the money supply or else the whole thing is going to implode. We're starting to be proven correct, right? I mean, it didn't take very long. M2 going negative, slightly negative in terms of growth rate. You know, interest rates obviously going up quite a bit. You know, huge amount. But and bingo, you know, things start breaking. And you know, more to come. I mean, you know, commercial real estate, there are a lot of areas where, you know, the low interest rate environment that we lived in for so many years got people off sides. You know, people bought long duration, low yield assets using deposits or cost of capital that they thought was going to be low or free, and they levered themselves up. And when that trade goes the other way, you know, you get in trouble quickly, and that's what we're seeing.
Yeah. Were you surprised at all by how quickly the Fed stepped in to basically bail out depositors of Silicon Valley Bank?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I wasn't. I kind of thought it was 50-50. I mean, I now at a public policy level and not having, you know, depositors and not having massive bank runs, you know, I see why they did it. I see why they had to do it. I mean, if you think it through, you know, if they hadn't done what they did and they had let, you know, let's say they had done just an FDIC, you know, FDIC took receivership of the bank last week. And in a normal situation, the FDIC would just sell off the assets on a regulated, you know, regular basis and pay out the proceeds. And if there was a hole left at the end, so be it. I mean, the Dodd-Frank rules, you know, basically said we are not going to have any more bailouts. And so there was going to be a bail-in, and the depositors, certainly all the equity holders were wiped out, all the bondholders were wiped out. And even the depositors were supposed to take a haircut under Dodd-Frank and the way it was constructed. And I don't know how big the haircut would have been. We pro-formed it out. It looked like, you know, there was about $190 billion of assets there. And it looked like there was probably a $20 to $40 million hole. All the equity was gone for sure. And that's why they couldn't find a buyer. I mean, if there had actually been value there, somebody would have bought the thing, right? But nobody's going to say, I'm going to buy this thing unless, you know, why buy something that's got a hole, it's a hole in the ground unless you're guaranteed. So really the buyer of last resort became who it always is, which is the government. And, you know, what would have happened if they had not stepped in is every single depositor in the country would have, you know, who was over 250, or not everyone, but a lot of them would have on Monday morning said to their bank, you know, transfer my money to my new account or take my deposit over and above $250,000 and turn it, you know, buy T-bills with it, right? And so that, think of how devastating that would have been for the entire banking industry, you know, and so you would have had a cascade. It wouldn't have been just Silicon Valley. There would have been tens or twenties or hundreds of banks in trouble. And so, you know, that kind of a contagion. I mean, everybody knows the story. Everyone's seen It's a Wonderful Life. Everyone knows what the 30s were like. There's just no way that, you know, as a public policy matter, they could let that happen. So they came up with this creative way, you know, and of course they've been disingenuous, if not outright lying, when they say that, you know, it's not a bailout and it's not going to cost the taxpayers money, because it is a bailout. And, you know, I mean, maybe in terms of tax coming out of the P&L of the balance sheet, or the P&L of the government, it's not going to cost money. But the fact of the matter is that they're plugging a hole by printing new money, and that's debasement, which then leads to inflation, which every taxpayer suffers from inflation. So they're being disingenuous in the way they've described it.
Yeah. On that note, I guess, I think you said the bearish case for gold and Bitcoin is a fiscally responsible government and central bank.
Right.
I guess, does this playing out kind of, you know, decrease the possibility of the bear scenario?
I think so. I mean, I think so. You know, yeah. I mean, you must have listened to some of my past podcasts. If people ask me, saying, what could go wrong? I said, the government gets really responsible, you know. And then they always laugh at me like, yeah, that's okay. I'm not too worried, right? Because we've all seen the government operate for, you know, as long as we've been alive, and it's government responsibility is an oxymoron. That's just not going to happen. And so, yeah, this is, as I said, this is another, I mean, to me, it was a big and important card being turned over, you know, that said, all right, they must continue to grow credit, continue to print money, continue to debase the currency. Because if they don't, the system they've devised, you know, this fractional reserve system that they built, is going to collapse on itself. And so it's really math. I mean, this is no, you know, stunning insight. It might be a stunning insight to Jay Powell. I doubt it. I think he probably knows it too, but he was hoping he could increase rates enough for long enough to get inflation under control. And who knows, maybe he will have. I mean, maybe when things really turn down, the inflation will come back in a good bit and, you know, give them a little bit of cover. But at the end of the day, they are going to have to continue to grow the money supply and print money if they want to have a functioning financial system. I mean, It's one of the things a lot of people tend to forget. The Fed has two mandates, right? They have a full employment mandate, or as close to full employment as possible, and then they have a price stability mandate. And now the full employment, they're actually doing okay because, you know, people are working three jobs just to, you know, deal with inflation. So, and there are a lot of people left the workforce, and a lot of boomers are retiring, and a lot of demographics that, you know, make the, and they've counted a lot of people as being out of the workforce, which isn't really correct. But suffice it to say that they look better on the full employment mandate than they do on the inflation mandate, which obviously, given the COVID stimulus and all the, you know, the 46% growth in the money supply in a 2-year time frame, you know, the inflation mandate, they're losing horribly on that, which is why they slammed on the brakes so hard. And the thing is a problem is they don't understand that it's not just about interest rates, the inflation. It's a supply chain issue, and it's a capacity issue. And so they're trying to squelch demand by pushing up interest rates and, you know, causing people to lose their jobs and slowing the economy down and et cetera, et cetera. And that's one way of doing it. It's kind of a blunt attack. The alternative way of doing it would be to try to encourage investment, keep rates low, and, you know, create more supply of everything, which would then lead to prices coming down. So, and I would contend that's a little more constructive. And more importantly, first of all, we shouldn't have a Federal Reserve at all. But if we do, they should be much more measured in their approach. I mean, I've said this in other podcasts I've done. They kind of veer between, you know, extreme ease, right, ZERP, free money, really, which, you know, leads to bubbles. And then, oh, the bubble bursts, the inflation's roaring, you know, what do we do now? Holy shit, we got to slam on the brakes, you know. And so that back and forth, I mean, it makes it very hard for any business person, or really for all of us, to kind of understand what's going on in the economy, because we're getting, you know, we've got this crazy guy driving the car back and forth from the inflation to the deflation guardrail. So it's hard.
Yeah. What do you think the most likely path is for the Federal Reserve here? You know, is the Fed going to go full on dovish and will Bitcoin and gold, you know, perform extremely well, or will the Fed try to continue keeping rates elevated for longer?
Yeah, I think they know they have to keep them, you know, I mean, we would love them to just pivot and turn and print like crazy and our stuff would go nuts. I mean, I would love that. And I think that could happen. But to me, that only really happens in a March of 20 scenario or an October of 08 scenario. I mean, the financial system has to be literally threatened with shutting down. And then they will, you know, we know they will print because, you know, they'll view the risk of inflation as being less than the risk of the financial system collapsing. So I think you need to operate with the view that it has to be a catastrophe to get them to really ease that much. Having said that, I think they will, you know, zigzag back and forth, and they'll try, you know, they're going to do a lot of different games, right? One, they'll try and probably game the inflation statistics, say it's lower than it is. Two, they may raise the inflation target. You know, we've seen some people floating the idea that, you know, maybe we don't need 2%. Maybe we should be okay with 3 or 4%, you know. You know, there'll be different games that they will play, and they'll try to keep the market off balance and just hope and pray that inflation comes down. But I do think eventually there will be the kind of financial crack up that will force them into really easing. And I'm, you know, kind of very similar to these other events. You know, I think what we saw with Silicon Valley Bank was a kickoff to the next one. And I can't tell you if it's tomorrow, a month from now, 2 months from now, a year from now. I don't think it goes as long as 2 years. I think I think things are rolling. And I think, you know, you have to remember, I mean, as we all know with fractional reserve banking and with the circular nature of the economy, you know, somebody loses their job and then they don't buy something that they were going to buy. And the person who makes that, they lose their job. And, you know, it can feed on itself. And, that hasn't started to happen yet, but, you know, the housing area is not doing great. And, you know, I think there are more shoes to drop.
If it does start to feed on itself and the Fed has to, you know, do a full on pivot, is there a scenario where there's like an all out hyperinflation?
Yeah, I think there is. I don't know if it's this next wave. I mean, I kind of feel like we're either heading to a world where we're going to have really high inflation for a bunch of years, and I kind of like to think of like Argentina, you know what I mean, where inflation is just going to become a fact of life. It's going to suck, but it will live with it. And, at least people will be working and the economy will be running. It's just that everything will always be getting more expensive. People are going to be really pissed off. But I think that's one probably more likely outcome than an out-and-out hyperinflation. But it's also possible that we could go the hyperinflation route. A lot of it depends on two things. It depends on the government policies, and it depends on the psychology. And the government policies are, I mean, if we got an MMTer in here, and we decided that universal basic income was a good idea, and we decided that deficits didn't matter, and we literally decided, okay, we're going to run a $3 trillion deficit every year at the federal level, and we're just going to print it. And, maybe the next year it'll be even bigger. We don't know. That kind of signaling and those kinds of actions would eventually trigger what you and I know very well, which is Gresham's Law, where everyone says, oh my God, these dollars are getting worse less every day. I've absolutely got to get into something that can't be printed. And the two natural alternatives are gold and Bitcoin. So, and they would just start going up and they wouldn't stop. It would be kind of relentless. And if you look at Weimar and if you look at hyperinflation, that's what really tips the scale from just a high inflation to a hyperinflation is when half of the people or more involved in the country, maybe not even half, but a big percentage of the people involved come to the conclusion that, you know what? They can never stop printing. This is just, there's no one who's going to get this under control. We are doomed. And then what you see is the crack-up boom, which is the rush to buy stuff that can't be replicated because nobody wants to hold money. And it feeds on itself. I mean, I'm sure we haven't talked about it, but I'm sure you're very familiar with, and your listeners are familiar with this whole debt doom loop that James Lavish and others have been, and I have been talking about. I mean, so the government, spends money more than they bring in, and they use they raise they sell bonds to pay for that, and those bonds have an interest rate on them, and as long as as inflation is low, it all kind of works. It worked for 40 years because the trend in inflation and interest rates was low, and inflation was low. The problem is when inflation starts to pick up and go up, everything goes in the other direction. And so now the government interest expense has gotten large, and now the bonds are selling off, and now interest rates go up. And so as interest rates go up, and now the government's running larger deficits because the economy is going to roll over. And so this creates a doom loop where, as the government spends more and borrows more, rates go up, and therefore interest costs go up, and it gets worse. And so the more the interest costs go up, the bigger the deficit. The bigger the deficit, the more bonds they got to sell. No one's there to buy the bonds, so the interest rate goes higher to entice, you know what I mean? And pretty soon, you've got an interest rate of 8, 9, 10%, which this country could never live under. I mean, the whole country would go bankrupt. And so then the central bank says, all right, we're not letting interest rates go that high. It's untenable in terms of the way the economy would work. We'll buy those bonds. And that's that, then now you've crossed over into third world kind of behavior and territory, right? I mean, that's what every single currency failure grew out of, was when the government couldn't control their spending, and they decided to spend it anyway, and they tried to sell bonds in the beginning, which kind of sterilized it and would have made it okay, but they couldn't find buyers for the bonds. The interest rates on the bonds went too high, and they didn't like that, so they became the buyer of the bond. But what do they buy the bond with? They buy the bond with money they print. And by the way, the money they print makes it worse. And so there's your doom loop. And yeah, I mean, I personally kind of expect hyperinflation within a 10-year window. I mean, outside 10 years. I actually probably think it's in shorter than that, maybe in the 5, 6, 7 year range. I think this next move will be pretty substantial. And I don't know, I could be wrong. I mean, this next move could be it. But I don't think enough of society has figured it out yet, so that we have a big enough percentage to do the crack-up boom thing.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of terrifying when you lay it out like that so simply. I guess what do you think the geopolitical implications of, a hyperinflation? I mean, that
Well,
seems.
they're not good. I mean, sadly, I mean, history on these things is, often surrounded by wars, or it leads to wars later. I mean, German hyperinflation led to Hitler getting into power. You know, lots of hyperinflations that have led to bad things. I mean, you know, China hyperinflated, Mao came into power. You know, and you see, you know, you've got kind of competing currency blocks, right? I mean, the West is the leader in the hyperinflation game, and the East, they're all making their bets on gold. And maybe to a degree, Bitcoin. I think Russia's probably mining Bitcoin covertly, but, you know, it could certainly lead to, you know, to conflict. I mean, I'm kind of an optimist on this book. I mean, I could be wrong, but I kind of believe that enough people understand the horrors of war and the horrors of a nuclear war that's not what will happen, that we'll have a lot of these shitty little wars where there'll be kind of proxy fighting, but that no one will ever be stupid enough to let a little war turn into a big war, because, you know, now we've got a big war. I mean, the next big war could end the planet. So I kind of think that, I tend to think of what will happen. I mean, in a best case and most likely case scenario, we're going to have extremely high inflation, and it's going to continue and persist, and people are going to start to get really, really pissed. And that's going to lead to some political change. And there'll be, you know, believe it or not, in my opinion, there'll actually be calls to return to a sound money standard. I mean, the inflation will be so bad that people say, you know, tell me what it takes. You know, what do we have to do to get out of this? And, you know, gold, Bitcoin, oil, whatever it might be. But somebody will come up with something that's better than what we've got and sell it to the people, and we'll migrate there. I mean, you know, in the interim, you know, these idiots might try CBDCs. I mean, there's a lot of talk about bad or stupid solutions. And, of course, as fiat's failing, one of the things that's going to happen, somebody's going to come and say, well, no, fiat's failing. It's just that fiat. We'll create a new one. It'll be better. But I think, I think as long as the same people are involved, I don't think anybody's going to trust it. You know, I think people are, you know, like, hey, look, you burned me once. You know, yeah, you're going to do another fiat experiment? You want me to be a part of it? No, I don't think so. I'll keep my Bitcoin. I'll keep my gold. So, you know, it's very hard, Joe, to know exactly how things unfold. There are just so many variables. But the pattern of history says that generally, you know, once you start down this road and you get as indebted as we are, you get the off-balance sheet liabilities, you get the political constellation that we have, I don't see how we reverse it. I mean, yeah. You know, I mean, if you had a constitutional convention, you know, and you had real political will to fix it, I suspect you could. But I don't see, you know, I don't see who's going to do it. I don't see the intelligent leaders that are thinking in that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. Foundation is one of my favorite Bitcoin companies. Their product, Passport, is one of the best Bitcoin hardware wallets on the market. It is air-gapped and highly secure. I strongly encourage you to go to foundationdevices.com and use the code BLOCKWARE and get $10 off your Passport. It's a great way to easily and securely store the private keys to your Bitcoin. I'm curious, you know, over the last week with the banking crisis that's been going on, have you had any family, friends, or clients, you know, reach out to you and ask, you know, more questions about Bitcoin?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've had a lot. I mean, I'm kind of known as a gold guy and a Bitcoin guy, and a lot of people who know that but don't always stay in touch with me on a regular basis, you know, they see, I mean, the Silicon Valley Bank thing, I think it really woke a lot of people up. I mean, I don't know what your experience is. I mean, I was just watching the local TV news last night, and it was all over there. They were talking about it. And, you know, I mean, the president had to come on the TV and reassure everybody that the banks are safe, right? I mean, you know, it's kind of that doesn't happen every day. And so yes, I've gotten a lot of inquiries. We've gotten a lot of inquiries on our fund. I've gotten a lot of personal friends calling and saying, wow, what is this? What does this mean? You know, and that's how these things happen, too. I mean, you know, there are kind of early adopters in new trends and new ideas. And then there's, you know, just the average person in the street is just, you know, trying to live their life and not focusing on, you know, the new stuff. But then as events occur and the events are disturbing, people go, wow, that's interesting. What does that mean? And so they try and sort it all out. So, yes, I think, you know, a lot of things happened in the last week. I mean, J.P. Morgan got a lot of new deposit customers, right? Because, you know, they're the Fed's bank, and if you're worried about the banks going down, you might as well be with the biggest one. So, I mean, people are waking up. That was my experience. I had probably a dozen calls from people who were intrigued.
Nice. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Same here. A lot of people, I think, have been paying more attention to what's been going
right,
on.
Right.
I'm curious to get your thoughts on this one. What do you think about a spot Bitcoin ETF? Like, I know some people argue that the gold price has been suppressed over time.
Yeah.
Do you worry that something like that could happen with Bitcoin? And do you think, you know, a spot ETF or ETFs in general?
There are actually two questions there, I'll take them both. I mean, the first one, let's talk about the spot ETF. They should have had a spot ETF a long time ago. I mean, that's, you know, they have a spot short ETF. I mean, it's criminal, and it's an example of how threatened the government is by this technology and the fact that they haven't approved it. And I mean, you know, my kudos to Grayscale for suing them, and I hope they win. And we own Grayscale, and you know, I think the discount's ridiculous. You need an ETF. Now, you need an ETF run by honest people who you know are going to actually have the coins. That's a big if, because I don't think GLD has all the gold it says it has, and it's, you know, custodied and administered by some people that I think are on the other side of this trade. But, you know, I trust the GBTC guys. I'm pretty sure they have the coins they say they have. And so, you know, and it's pretty easy to check and audit, too. So in the gold space, the way they kept the price down was they used the derivatives. And this is, to me, this is also the risk in the Bitcoin space that people are going to and have created and will continue to create paper Bitcoin, just like there's paper gold. And we all know that there's only real Bitcoin that, you know, settles back to the ledger. We know what that is. But, you know, on the side, as a side bet, you know, party A and party B can say, we're going to bet on the price of Bitcoin. And if A wanted to be long it and B wanted to be short it, you know, and they did that deal, well, you just reduced some of the natural demand that A would have gone and bought the Bitcoin in the market and therefore pushed the price up. And so, you know, it's these derivatives have the potential to have to develop in a way that makes the Bitcoin price behave like the gold price. Having said that, Bitcoiners don't get all panicked, because they got a long way to go. I mean, we've got, you know, we probably got 100 gold derivatives for every, you know, claims on gold for every 1 ounce in existence. And, you know, the Bitcoin derivatives today, you know, if you go to Glassnode or you look at some of the numbers, I mean, it's, you know, it's 6 billion, 8 billion, something like that. It might have gotten bigger now. I haven't looked recently. But, you know, so there's not as much derivative activity. And I don't think that paper Bitcoin is affecting the Bitcoin price very much today. But that doesn't mean that it can't or it couldn't at some point in the future. And furthermore, and I've said this in other podcasts, I mean, I think, you know, when you think about derivatives, they really are a way to manipulate markets, because the people with the biggest balance sheet and the people who have the unlimited ability to be backstopped, they can bet bigger than everybody else. And this is like being in a poker game where, you know, if you don't have the money and you can't, you know, you can't call the bluff, you know, the guy who's bluffing is going to win by definition because he's got the biggest balance sheet. And that's the problem with derivatives everywhere. And in my opinion, in the next reset, when this whole thing blows up and we go to a sound money standard and we put in a new Glass-Steagall and, you know, a new 33 Act and so on, and a new 40 Act, one of the things we've got to do is ban derivatives, except for in connection with legitimate commercial transactions. Like, if you're a farmer growing corn, you ought to be able to sell your corn to General Mills on a futures basis so you can get paid, so you can do what you need to do. But that's a legitimate hedge of a physical product. It's not somebody with a big balance sheet saying, I'm going to take a position in this thing, and I'm going to drive it, you know, in such a direction because I'm the biggest player and nobody can match me. So that's the risk, right?
Yeah, I think that was very well articulated. Who do you think, like, in the gold market, who are the biggest players doing that? Is it like the banks? Is it the central banks? Is it the government? Or
it starts at the BIS, which is the central bank for central banks in Switzerland. And then it goes to the central banks all around the world who coordinate their actions. And then it also goes to the big banks within each country that are kind of supported by the central banks. And, you know, it's done through things like the Exchange Stabilization Fund. I mean, I don't think most people know, but the Treasury has something called an Exchange Stabilization Fund that, you know, Mnuchin took up to $800 billion. And before that, it was about $200 billion. And that's basically a slush fund. This got set up after the crash of 87, which I was starting in the business when that occurred. And it became called the Plunge Protection Team. And the notion was that, you know, rapid moves in markets could create disequilibrium and could make the country somewhat vulnerable. And so we need to have the Fed and the Treasury collectively kind of, and it's, you know, really is both in concert, I think, need to have a fund where they can lean on markets at certain points of time if they think they're doing things that don't serve the interests of the country. And so, you know, one of the great problems that we all face, it makes it so hard to do what we do if we're in the investment management business, is that we're actually dealing with markets that are manipulated. You know what I mean? And that's, you know, that's tough, right?
Yeah. I guess thinking about like the gold derivative market or Bitcoin derivative market, in my mind, it's like gold, if you're long gold, it's kind of very difficult to verify that you're actually like holding up real gold. Whereas like with Bitcoin, if the derivative market got to a certain size, if we just said, hey, if you're long Bitcoin, take self-custody of it because it's pretty easy, or at least verify that someone has taken self-custody of it. Do you think that can prevent the derivative market from?
Absolutely. It would help. It would absolutely help. But, you know, you know, nobody who's a real Bitcoiner would be stupid enough to accept paper Bitcoin, right? I mean, you know, if the paper Bitcoin's out there and there are financial players out there who are willing to play in that game, both long and short, you know, they could, if it got big enough, they could move the price. I mean, I think we have to accept that. I mean, I think I know some Bitcoiners say, well, we can see it all. It's all on the chain. It's there. There's no way they can manipulate it. And I think they're missing the fact that there are, you know, anything in the world that exists, people can make a side bet on. And the side bets, you know, can become bigger than the underlying. And that's a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's really kind of what I'm talking about.
Makes sense. I kind of want to shift to a different topic.
Sure.
Do you know what's been going on with Caitlin Long's Custodia Bank?
Oh, yeah. So my fund is an investor in the bank. I talk to Caitlin regularly, and I know it extremely well. Yeah. In fact, you may have seen it. There was a great Spaces yesterday that she was on where she really went into depth. You should look it up or link it in your show notes, where she really went into depth on how badly they've been treated. I mean, it's been, as you know, this Nick Carter laid it out too, this Operation Chokehold. I mean, the government, the government, and I think it's really not just the government, but I think it's the banks behind the government. I think it's the Jamie Dimons of the world. I mean, all of these people understand what an existential threat Bitcoin is to their models and to their business. And so as a result of that, these people have really done a number on this industry. I mean, Silvergate had their own set of problems, somewhat mismanaged, et cetera, and went down. But, you know, Signature, as far as I understand it, was fine. And there are plenty of people who've tweeted it, Nick Carter included, who talked about even Barney Frank, who was on the board of Signature, saying, hey, this was a hit job. You know, the bank was fine. They wanted this thing out of the box because it's crypto. And, you know, a lot of this stems from the problem that, you know, I mean, and we were all warning everybody, you probably were too, about Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX, right? But, you know, the SEC and Washington, D.C. and the investor protection agencies, they just got caught with their pants down so badly on FTX. I mean, it's just, and Luna and all the other stuff. I mean, the rug pulls there were enormous. And so, you know, now they're trying to close the barn door. That horse has escaped. I mean, a lot of fraudulent players and most of those people who are trying to hurt Bitcoin don't understand that Bitcoin's different than, you know, all the other stuff, all the shit coins. But the point is that, you know, that kind of thing, I think, has led to an overreaction on the part of politicians, you know, putting Bitcoin in the same bucket, saying all these things are bad. We're going to throw this baby and all the bathwater out. And that's a shame because Bitcoin's a solution, as you know. And for those of your listeners who don't know, Caitlin runs something called Custodia Bank. And Custodia Bank was trying to become a crypto bank that was not fractional reserve, that was fully reserved. In fact, it was 108% reserved, which would be to say that they'd have 8% capital and 100 cents on the dollar. If you put money with them to buy their stablecoin, the money would still be there. So, and, you know, they were denied a bank charter and they were denied access to the Fed window. And they did this because, you know, the people that are in power at JP Morgan and other places do not want to see this kind of a bank get going. Because if they do, and some of the services they can provide, the instant settlement they can provide, et cetera, that would be very, very threatening to the legacy banking system. So, yeah, I know Caitlin well. And what she said on the spaces last night was that, you know, it was a really organized hit job down in D.C. I mean, they responded. She said they've done a number of things. The government has done a number of things that are blatantly illegal, that they've never been done before. That, I mean, she's the great thing about her, she's a tiger. She's going to take them to court, and she's going to win on some of the, I mean, some of the stuff, I think. And she'll start up. She will get her bank going eventually, but, you know, there's probably another year wrangling in front of her to get the right to do it.
Yeah, I hope she's successful there. I didn't know the update of she's eventually going to take them to court and try to get this really moving. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's she's a real pro, and she's a real credit to the industry. You know, and some people knock her because they say, well, she's not a maxi enough. She doesn't hate the fiat people enough. But let's face it, if we really want to have this industry work, we need to build a bridge between the legacy and the new. And what she's trying to do is build an honest bridge. And it would be good. I mean, I'm sure you've read Jason Lowry's thesis. I mean, the notion that, I mean, the U.S. should lead in Bitcoin and in crypto. I mean, we should, but Bitcoin particularly. We should try and take a leadership role, because it's very clear that this is the way things are going to work in the future. The advantages, the instant settlement, the speed, et cetera. I mean, you can be your own bank, more or less. And so, to me, that's a very compelling reason why you want to be in Bitcoin, because it is the future of money.
Yeah, I'm definitely in the process of reading Jason's thesis. I mostly agree that it's very interesting. I guess, like, do you think it's going to be effective? Like, do you think someone within the U.S. government is going to be like, hey, I read this, or I understand the ideas at least behind this, and, like, the U.S. should accumulate Bitcoin?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, that's what Jason's working towards. That's what we're all working towards. But sadly, I think it's going to take some time. I don't think it'll happen immediately. But I do think it will happen. I think when they get some more regulations in place, I mean, you know, Gensler really screwed up by letting all these shitcoins live and by not cracking down on FTX and Luna and all that stuff. And, you know, we actually arguably need a little bit more regulation to make the big institutions comfortable. Because once the big institutions come in, there's not going to be enough room for them, and the price is going to go up a great deal. To me, it's all part of the plan, and it may take a little longer than we like. It may not, but I'm trying to prepare myself mentally for it could take longer, because it's a big change, you know. So,
yeah, it's a massive change. Earlier, you were talking about how countries in the East are accumulating gold. Do you think that some may be accumulating Bitcoin in secret, or do you think that, like, I know, like, there's rumors that Russia is like mining Bitcoin in Siberia. Yeah. Do you think that that's, you know, common, or do you think they're all kind of maybe not doing it, or just like kind of dipping their toe into Bitcoin space?
I would guess most of them are dipping their toe. If they're not, they're nuts. I suppose a few of them aren't, like China, you know, it's always been pretty hostile towards it. I'm pretty sure Russia is doing it and trying it. I mean, once you really study, if you study it with an open mind, I mean, you have to come to the conclusion that you and I have come to, which is, you know, it's a good network. It stores value, 21 million coins, and that's going to matter. And in a deflationary world, you want to own one of these things, you know, or several of these things. And so I think that, you know, I think it's coming. I really do. Again, you know, it's one set of people at a time. You know, like we're really cutting edge. I mean, we may feel like we're late because we weren't here in 2013 or something, but I guess I bought my first coins in like 2016, 2014. I don't know, somewhere in there. But the point is that, you know, we're not. We're just not late. I mean, you know, in 20 years we might be late, but, you know, that's 20 years from now. So,
Yeah, I agree. I definitely don't think anyone is late to Bitcoin at this point. I know, like, from your background, you studied, you know, at some of the top schools in the country, and you, I would imagine you identify as more of like an Austrian type guy rather than a Keynesian.
I do, yeah, very much so.
How did you, I guess, avoid, you know, becoming a Keynesian out of school?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, you know, the issue wasn't as clearly drawn back then, and I was in the venture capital business, and so we weren't talking about sound money. I was just talking about growing technology companies, and yet I was watching all of this other stuff, and I was reading all the Austrian texts, and as you're probably aware, it's very hard to get an Austrian education. I mean, I guess Hill still has, you know, a program, and the von Mises Institute has a program, but, you know, the average U.S. College is going to teach you Keynesianism, period. I had a Keynesian professor I get in arguments with all the time. I got a shitty grade, but, you know, I didn't care. You know, it's, you just got to think for yourself. I mean, I guess it's the bottom line. But there are a lot of people in the industry, in the financial industry, in all these industries who, you know, they'd rather just kind of go along and get paid well to, you know, toe the party line. And the party line is Keynesianism. I mean, you know, it's just, it's been beat into everybody's head. You know, I think wrongly so. I mean, I could logically smash it in 10 minutes, but that doesn't, you know, it doesn't really matter. I mean, everybody lives that life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious, like, what's your counter argument to, I guess, the Keynesians that say, hey, you need money supply growth to incentivize people, you know, investing and not holding on to the dollars, but, you know, putting it into useful projects. What would be your counter argument to that?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Look, yeah, the excess of savings and the money's not going to, I mean, humans have a desire to improve themselves and to improve their lives. And, you know, the whole Keynesian animal spirits are necessary to make the economy go wrong. No, bullshit. Animal spirits lead to bubbles and bursts, right? That's all. Animal spirits lead to people doing stupid shit. You know, what we really need is we need an economy that works like a Swiss watch where, you know, you've got very precise inputs and very precise outputs. And if you have the proper cost of capital, then businessmen are going to make the right decisions about what to build and what not to build. And we're all going to live a higher standard of living because it's going to be more efficiency. I mean, the you know, these wide swings in the cost of capital or this mispricing the cost of capital leads to people making decisions that are malinvestments, that are not correct decisions, and that then come back to bite them in the ass, and they lose money on them, and the capital gets destroyed. And the reason they did it was, at the time, given what was going on, it looked like a logical thing to do. But, you know, it wasn't a logical thing to do because the money is broken and they were being fooled by an incorrect price of the money. If you had a fixed amount of the money, then everyone would be looking at it and going, okay, you know, and I've got to be able to generate something that gives me a return well above the return I'm going to get, you know, on my own, and therefore I will take my capital and I'll put it over there and I'll risk it, you know, to earn that higher rate of return. So it's, you know, it's an efficiency thing is really what it is. I mean, the Keynesian model has always been premised on you must have growth. You absolutely must have growth. Otherwise we stagnate and we fall into the Great Depression. I mean, you know, part of the Keynesian model that is so broken is they thought the Great Depression occurred, in a sense, because of lack of demand. And what they didn't interpret the Great Depression in the proper way. I mean, the proper way of it is it was a huge bubble that burst. Of course, there was no demand. You'd pulled all the demand forward, and, you know, now there's none left. And by the way, everyone borrowed a lot and got way in debt, and nobody has any capital. So, you know, that's what that was all about, not a lack of animal spirits. You know, if you had never let the whole boom take place, you wouldn't have had the bust. But the minute the Fed got control of the money supply in 1913 and got control of the interest rates, you know, and they said, well, we're only going to accept, we're just here to backstop the banks, accept good collateral at high rates, you know, what Bagot used to say, and at high rates for, you know, to keep things going. And they immediately violated that charter in finance World War I. and created a ton of money that then led to the bubble, you know, 20, and then the further bubble in 29. So it's just it's a broken system, very badly broken. The money is broken.
Yeah, I think that's well said, and I think that's probably a good spot to wrap it up since now we have something like Bitcoin. Lawrence, thanks so much for coming on. I think everyone's going to love this. Any final thoughts or where people can find you?
No, not really. I mean, I would just suggest to people that don't, you know, I always say to people, don't use leverage. These transitions, we're really transitioning between a couple of really big systems, you know. And so there's going to be a lot of violent moves. There's a good Mermican chart that's out on the web that just shows how much things can swing. And so, you know what you own, know why you own it. Don't necessarily worry too much about the day-to-day price. If they can't take it away from you, you're going to be fine. And that, therefore, the no leverage. And, you know, I think Bitcoin is the fastest horse in the race. Gold is the least volatile horse in the race. They both protect you, though, against the coming, you know, monetary debasement, which I think is going to be very substantial. And I think everybody who protects themselves in retrospect is going to be very glad they did. So that would be my suggestion.
Awesome. Love it. Everyone go follow Lawrence on Twitter if you haven't already. But yeah, this is a great episode. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Joe. Nice talking to you.